Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to speak only about hoax cases, or at any rate, those that I or others consider to be hoax cases. This does not mean, and I stress this, it does not mean that I regard all otherwise inexplicable sighting, landing and contact reports as hoaxes. If I did so regard them, I would never have founded Cosmos in the first place. However, it is a fact that a proportion, and I would say a fair proportion, are hoaxes of one form or another. And it's part of this proportion that I am going to present to you tonight and discuss with you. The Skorriton mystery is a case on its own, and it is for this reason that I composed the précis of the case that I hope you managed to get a copy of on your way in. Cosmos members should recognise it as pages 9 and 10 of their current journal, at least those who've got the Cosmos journal yet should. Anyway, I shall leave the Skorriton mystery until last and then carry on with the story from where this précis leaves off. Now, I'm only going to speak tonight either of cases I've had a connection with myself, I hasten to add not in the capacity of hoaxer, or cases where I know the people concerned. So there will be little or no question of the facts having become distorted en route from their source. In other words, I'm not going to attempt to pass judgment on any of the well-known contactees, as with one exception, Dan Fry, with whom I was quite reasonably impressed. I've never met any of them. Now, there are, of course, many different types of hoax, and I shall include in this talk examples both of intentional and unintentional misreporting and exaggeration. I shall also refer to various sighting and contact reports, photographs, tape recordings, and psychic manifestations. The point, though, should be made that hoaxes can be pulled with different intentions. That of playing a practical joke on a friend or friends, to test out UFO societies and investigators, for publicity and notoriety, for financial benefit, although it isn't usually likely to result, or because the hoaxer can't help it. He or she is a pathological liar. Two other points should be made. There's the possibility of hoaxes by space people or psychic entities, and I'll have more to say about that later on, and also the point that it's possible for people to start a hoax with the best of motives. For example, to make up and broadcast sighting and or contact reports and forecasts of contacts in a particular area in the hope of attracting extraterrestrial attention by this means. And I should perhaps make the point here that I do not particularly have Warminster in mind when I say that. Certainly there are many misreports, bad reports, and probably quite a number of hoaxes there. But I should go on record as saying that Warminster is the only place in the country where I've seen a UFO twice, and that the same goes for several other people I know. Now, you know, it occurred to me that when I was first drafting out this talk, that if I wanted to have a few friends left afterwards, I'd better not talk about all the cases of misrepresentation I know of. Indeed, there wouldn't be time, not if I took two or even three evenings. So, in fact, I've done quite a bit of judicious pruning. Even so, I think that perhaps one or two of the instances may well surprise you. So to revert to cases, and incidentally, also to Warminster. Now, just to show you how easy it is for even those in a responsible position to get into a hoaxing mood, the first Skywatch I ever went to some years ago, there were four Bufora committee members there, including myself. And our immediate reaction on getting out of the car at Crockerton near Warminster was, "Can't we think of a good hoax?" This idea, however, was immediately dropped when we saw a large Saturn-shaped saucer low in the sky. After about 10 seconds, though, it turned out to be a case of the would-be biter's bit, the culprit being the moon, refraction, and a high straight wisp of cloud that had neatly bisected the moon and deceived us. And as I said, talk of hoaxing was dropped from then on. Still thinking about Bufora committee members, and in case you think I'm exempting Cosmos committee members, by the way, I ought to point out that I haven't known them for quite so long and consequently haven't caught them out so much. Well, there goes my coffee and biscuits, perhaps. However, as I said, still thinking about Bufora committee members, Just about the best saucer photo I've seen was produced by one of them by the simple and well-tried expedient of photographing a hubcap thrown up in the air. I hasten to add, though, that this was not done with the intention of claiming a genuine sighting, but just to see whether such a photo could produce a genuine actual type UFO. In point of fact, it did. Now, our friend Fogel's photograph of an alleged saucer, as most of you know, unfortunately made the cover photo of the book The Flying Saucer Story. And this, by the way, is one of the items I was in two minds whether or not to judiciously prune. I decided to leave it in, though, as whilst it was connected with a former before a committee, it was also told to me personally. Now, Flying Saucer Review publicly revealed this as a fake, and Fogel himself admits to it being one. Now, several years ago, Fogel told verbally to a former before a committee member, but this was never told officially, to my knowledge, to the Bufora committee. Consequently, I was rather surprised to learn that the Flying Saucer Review editor considered this information to have been deliberately withheld from public knowledge, which was not the case. And quite frankly, in view of such concern about the truth being withheld, I'm rather surprised that Flying Saucer Review have never referred to the later facts discovered in the Bryant case, though in view of what I've just said, I made quite sure they were well aware of them. Yet these two clearly indicate a hoax. Not, in my opinion, a space hoax. Of course, you could take it that Fogel's was a space hoax, and that he was under evil space influences when he made his model saucer and he photographed it. But if one assumes this sort of thing, then evil space entities can be blamed for practically everything connected with our erring human nature. Though I suppose, you know, it's really a nice thought that it wasn't me, it was only that evil entity, that sadistic spirit or devilish diva that was looking over my shoulder at the time. Now, let me make it clear, though, that I don't entirely dismiss the possibility of space or spirit hoaxes occurring. My good friend Harold Chibet has, in fact, postulated the possible existence of a psychic hoax barrier, similar to a light or sound barrier, which we may have to pierce before arriving at the truth. What I do not think, however, is that we should cry space hoax at every possible opportunity, when in fact in most cases it is almost certainly hoaxing human nature. To do this is to denigrate our studies in the eyes of the very people outside the saucer sphere we are trying to convince and impress. They're certainly not going to go along with space hoaxes, they're just going to think we're trying to cover up. But to get back again to photos, and this time, movie film. Now, a friend of mine of quite long standing who lives in the Bexley area asked me over one night to see various films, one of which he'd taken himself quite nearby. This particular one, he told me in advance that it wasn't a UFO, and he asked me to guess what it was. The film lasted about a minute and showed an object which appeared circular in shape and darted over from one side of the picture to another, stopped, and then performed a typical saucer-like falling leaf descent. Now, had I not recognised the area, I would certainly have been fooled. But having some local knowledge, I did recognise the place and said after the minute was up, I'm willing to bet that that was over Danson Park and you were photographing a kite, which was in fact what he'd done. But there again, it looked far more like a UFO than a good many UFO pictures I've seen. There was absolutely no trace visible of any string, and it could well have been put forward as one of the comparatively few UFO films in existence. He assured me that, so far as he could tell, nothing would have given it away, even on a detailed examination. Fortunately, he was, and is, a very honest chap, but think how many others might not have been. Before leaving the photographic side of hoaxing, there's one other thought that occasionally crops up, this being when someone, usually unconnected with any society, sends you in a photo they've taken, or they say they've taken, and ask for your comments. This usually means that it's one they've made up themselves and you're on a hiding to nothing with your reply. A particular instance of this occurred to me about 18 months ago when someone in Scotland sent me down a photo of two fighters chasing a UFO in the middle distance with some trees on the foreground, and they just asked me for comments on the photo they'd taken. I had a good look at it and then wrote back to them saying that though I was no photographic expert, I considered it to be a remarkably good photograph. Probably of three models suspended from a thread of some sort. But if they provide me with a detailed report of the alleged sighting, together with a negative of the photograph, I'd be prepared to revise my opinion if necessary. Well, no sighting report was forthcoming, but in due course, three copy negatives arrived, each showing the three aerial objects, but in different positions, presumably having been taken quickly, one after the other. I took these round in point of fact to Captain Mackay, and we had an interesting half hour examining these projected onto a screen, when it was found that in one picture, the tailplane of one of the fighters, supposedly in the middle distance, beyond and behind the trees, just in one small spot, it overlapped a branch, which proved quite clearly that my original contention was correct, and that they were, all models, suspended on thread. So if anyone shows you photos of UFOs and just asks for your opinion, and is cagey about giving any other details, be a bit cagey yourself. Well, let's now leave photographs and turn our attention to models. And here I must admit to one rather flattening experience. You may well remember the hoax on the 5th of September 1967, which was quite widely reported in the press at the time, and also in SpaceLink, incidentally, later on, where apprentices at the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough made six bleeping smelly plastic saucers and dumped them in a line across southern England. Well, one of these was dumped on the Bickley Golf Course near Bromley in Kent. And before it was confirmed that they were all hoaxes, there was a lady interviewed on TV who lived in Bromley, and she said she'd seen the Bickley saucer swoop over her house during the night. Well, a few days later, by pure coincidence, I was due to give a talk on UFOs to a young conservative group in North Bromley, less than a mile from the actual spot. And, of course, I duly referred to these hoax saucers and made one or two caustic comments about the lady who'd seen this one performing aerobatics. And I will always remember the rather plaintive female voice, which as soon as I paused interjected the words, "That was my mother." And that, I must admit, rather took the wind out of my sail. Well, I don't think one can look at allegedly man-made saucers, models or full size, without referring to John Searle and his swallow. Well, I've never met or spoken with Mr. Searle, so until I have, I wouldn't like to give a final opinion. However, most people who have met him do seem a little chary of going into raptures about his claims. And I would recommend to those who haven't already seen it an article in one issue of the newsletter of the Society for the Investigation of UFO Phenomena of Surrey some months ago, in which a transcript of their interview with him was published. The latest man-made saucer to arrive on the scene is one mentioned recently both in the Cosmos Journal and SpaceLink. This particular one was apparently the brainchild of a Mr. Edward Jaggers of Glastonbury, who had a BSc after his name on his notepaper. This saucer was found by the roadside on September the 26th last, having a rotating white dome and coloured flashing lights and giving out a humming noise. It was 3 feet in diameter, and Mr. Jaggers claimed that it had taken off whilst he was experimenting with it. To quote from a letter from him, he said that the craft uses a method of iron propulsion that is the result of 20 years' research. He also alleges that the craft that got away was too badly damaged by police and forensic scientists to be put in working order. He states, too, that he's partially completed the designs for a man-carrying unit, on which, finances permitting, he hopes to commence construction soon. Well, that was Mr. Jaggers' version. According to the papers, the saucer weighed 100 weight, contained equipment only sufficient to produce the light, rotation and humming effects, and had just been dumped there. They also stated he claimed the saucer was worth £7,000. Well, I haven't met Mr. Jaggers, but he does write quite a good letter, so again, I'll reserve judgment until I do meet him. His £7,000 claim has been described as extravagant, but I'm not really sure that this is so when you consider that John Searle talks in terms of £1 million mark. Also, Mr. Jaggers has at least produced a saucer. Has anyone seen one of John Searle's swallows? Quite seriously, though, this does seem to be one of those cases where those who want to believe a flying saucer has been made will believe it without further ado, and those who don't wish to will rely on the newspaper reports, frequently a fatal thing to do, and condemn Mr. Jaggers out of hand. Mind you, naturally, if anyone here has examined the Glastonbury saucer and found it to be a load of junk, I'll bow to their superior knowledge. Until then, I'll keep an open mind on it. I referred just now to newspaper reports and suggested they should never be taken as gospel. There's another thing that should never be taken as gospel, particularly where hoaxes, suspected hoaxes, and anonymous letters are concerned, namely a postmark. Mind you, there is at least one exception to this rule, and that's a postmark, Finsbury Park, North 4. Should you ever have the misfortune to have doubtful communications thus labelled, it's a pound or a penny, they'll come from the Doctor Inn referred to in the Scorriton mystery. I'll be speaking more about him later on. Now, so far as London is concerned, it only takes half an hour or so by tube to convert a north or northwest postmark into an east, southeast, or southwest one. So you can never hope to trace a sender by this means. Just to illustrate the point, not so long ago, as a joke, I sent an anonymous spaceman contact type letter myself, fully expecting, knowing the recipient, that despite its being postmarked Southend-on-Sea, they would have little difficulty in identifying the perpetrator. But this proved to be the case. So I received back a similar type missive postmarked Bracknell, which was about 100 miles off course so far as the sender's own address was concerned. Well, I think I've made the point, but just as an aside and to emphasise it, about 4 years ago now, I was going down to Devon on one of my trips associated with the Bryant case. And two chaps in my office asked me if I'd post Valentine's to their girlfriends whilst I was down there so as to give them an apparently impossible postmark. This I duly did. But no one was more surprised than I when, having posted them in Exeter, I was duly thanked several days later on for having seen that they had an Axminster postmark on them. This one, I must admit, I've never quite figured out. Another point to bear in mind with anonymous letters, you know, is that it's extremely difficult for the person sending them to make sure that his or her writing cannot be recognised. This applies to typing too, of course. In fact, every typewriter is unique in this respect. Consequently, this is why anonymous letters will usually arrive in very poor handwriting or sprawling capitals with spelling mistakes. Or the safest, perhaps, words cut out of newspapers and stuck onto another sheet. I remember a couple of years back, several Bifora members received anonymous letters from an alleged Colonel Jardine, who apparently, to say the least, didn't think very highly of us. And he proposed to step in and put Bifora out of business. Exactly how wasn't disclosed. However, unfortunately for the gentleman concerned, he typed these letters, and I'd collected three of them from various people. They were obviously typed on the same machine, four letters all having the same peculiarities. And I looked through the Bifora membership application forms, and lo and behold, one of these had been typed on the self-same typewriter. So I wrote to this member saying we were having a bit of trouble with anonymous letters from his part of London, and I wondered if he would help us in our inquiries, giving him some of the details. Back came a letter, still on the same typewriter, saying yes, he would, but I shouldn't rely on postmarks. This one happened to be Walthamstow, and he was actually trying a double bluff. Anyway, I was now quite sure he was the culprit, so I wrote back thanking him, but saying we'd now located the gentleman concerned by means of typing similarities and quoted them, saying we decided to take no further action unless further letters were forthcoming, ending the letter by writing that I hoped he was now feeling better. I think the message got through because no more anonymous letters arrived. I've only ever had one anonymous communication whose source I've been unable to prove, at any rate so far, but you'll be hearing more about this later too. But it's surprising how much relevant information one can dig up by a visit to one of the larger reference libraries, for example, Holborn or Westminster Central. And the local libraries are very useful too for checking names on the electoral register. I've solved quite a few problems this way. If you have at your disposal in libraries the world's telephone directories, clerical, army, navy, air force lists and many others, always useful for checking bogus titles. Here are professional and business directories and all sorts of useful information. Now let me turn for a moment from actual hoaxes to exaggerations, which, whilst they're not quite the same thing, frequently bring about the same result, namely being the cause of people believing something that is not actually so. Now, some months ago here, it was stated that a young man in England investigating this particular aspect of ufology had discovered the existence here of six different cases of space children. Well, even from the meagre details given, I could pinpoint who was referred to. He is, in fact, a Cosmos member who has spent a great deal of time investigating both this aspect of flying saucers and the Cynthia Appleton case as well. His name is not secret by any means, and he's written to quite a number of journals asking for their help. In fact, he is a Mr. Paul Gregory of Newcastle-under-Lyme, and to my knowledge, he's discovered the existence only of one, not six, one suspected case of this kind. And both he and I agree that even this is a pretty doubtful one. Well, now, I've been nattering away for quite a while about various aspects of hoaxing, but my main theme tonight will be the different angles of the Skorritin mystery. I'll be speaking generally and not confining myself to Brian, so I'll now just refer quickly to one or two other items not connected with Skorritin, and then, so to speak, get on with the main course. However, let's turn for a moment to tape recordings. And here, just as I haven't referred to the controversial contactee cases in the States, of which I've no first-hand knowledge, neither am I going to refer to the varieties of 7-inch spools of tape that are also allegedly messages to men of Earth and that sort of thing. Each must be their own judge of these. There are, however, two reasonably well-known alleged occurrences of this nature in this country, those of Philip Rogers and those in the Skorritin mystery. Skorritin, as I said, I'll be coming to shortly. So far as Philip Rogers is concerned, many of his recordings are faint, as a lot of you know. And one must, of course, bear in mind that to compensate for his lack of sight, his hearing is ultra-sensitive. However, whilst it must be agreed that some of his items are open to question, it must also be pointed out that although some might put them in the category of hoaxes, albeit unintentional, Philip himself does do the utmost amount of checking possible to ensure that he can find no ordinary explanation. And I know he will be the first to eliminate one of his claims for which he found such an ordinary explanation. It should also be pointed out that at least three of his recordings, including his well-known time check, have been regarded as inexplicable by all those hearing them, so far as I'm aware. So whilst I might well be biased, inasmuch as Philip's a friend of mine, I certainly don't regard his recordings as hoaxes, intentional or accidental, though, as I say, neither would I automatically say they're all coming from space people. Before finally arriving at Skorritin, I'm just going to say a few words about psychic aspects of ufology. Well, again, the field is wide open to hoaxing. These aspects mainly fall into forms of poltergeist activity, messages and so on received whilst in trance, and messages received via a Ouija board or something similar. Tempting though they are, I'm going to omit poltergeist activity and also trance messages, as I could scarcely say much about these latter without referring to the Aetherius Society from the Reverend Dr. George King, and I have no intention at the moment of getting so embroiled. Ouija board messages, though. These I can speak of from personal experience, and you find, you know, quite frequently, you get some quite relevant information mixed up with some of the most horrible loads of old codswallops possible to come across. Whether the information one gets is true or false, it's more often than not incapable of proof, but sometimes you can get forecasts of UFO sightings or landings, usually at the most inaccessible places and horrible times of day or night. Only in two such cases I know of have there been any resultant sightings, but then, quite a lot, one is unable to follow up anyway. Now, so far as I can see, there are four possibilities regarding information obtained by this method, or any combination of them. Firstly, one of a group may be consciously and deliberately directing operations. Secondly, the results obtained may be directed by one or more of the group's subconscious mind. Thirdly, some spirit or other entity may be controlling the subconscious of one or more of the group. And lastly, messages may genuinely be coming from a psychic or extraterrestrial source. Personally, I go for the second or third possibilities, or perhaps a combination of the two. But each to his own, you may be more nearly correct than I am. Well, despite what I've just said, and before I finally do get to talking about Skorritin, though, I can't resist telling you of two such messages obtained by a small group of us. One concerned a lady who, we managed to establish, was in the middle of a Scottish field, apparently also in the middle of the somewhat dubious process of patting Bill. which certainly sounded rather peculiar, till further questions elicited the, facts that she was a vet and Bill was a horse. Another time we got in touch, so to speak, with, for want of a better word, a gentleman from Uranus, actually. I'm not sure whether he qualifies to be called a Uranian or a Uranusian, or for that matter, anything at all. Anyway, we were having considerable difficulty in ascertaining his sex, until finally we got a yes in answer to the question, are you a hermaphrodite? This, of course, made everything absolutely as clear as mud, particularly when we also established that apart from his having green skin, he, she, it, or they was also almost human in appearance. It didn't help either that we kept getting long pauses between question and answer, the reason apparently being that whatever it was looking up the code. Thereafter, I regret to say, we were unable to keep straight faces, as we were all trying to visualise a green-skinned hermaphroditic Uranian, or Uranusian, scurrying backwards and forwards to his captain, asking for permission to look up unclassified phrases in the version current on Uranus of English as she spoke. Well, I think that's a fitting point to draw a veil over further proceedings in that direction. So, without further ado, Scorism. Now, as those of you who are familiar with the story will know, even without further developments, it was complicated in all conscience to start with. So, rather than waste time going right through the story again, which would take up nearly the rest of the evening by itself, for the benefit of those who knew nothing or little or nothing about the case, I made a condensed précis of the story on the quarto sheets I trust you managed to collect as you came in. Now, this does cover the salient points of the case, sufficient at any rate for anyone to follow with a little added explanation, and what I shall have to say about the further side of the story so far as Bryant is concerned. Now, the time that the Scorison mystery was being printed and published was the time when the first adverse points were being discovered about the story. These quickly became more and more numerous, as I've related in the sequel to Scorison, until it became obvious, to me at any rate, that it was necessary to present these further facts in order that a balanced view of the case might be available. So, sequel to Scorison. Now, just about 3 weeks before, note before sequel to Scorison was due to be published, I'd just reached the gate going to work in the morning when the postman handed me a very neatly tied package which I duly took with me to work. Come lunchtime, I took it out of my briefcase to undo it, and it seemed obviously to be a book. Very professionally packed, and I wondered who the heck was sending me one since I hadn't ordered any. Anyway, I removed the covering paper, opened the top of the cardboard carton, then realised it was a copy of the Scorison mystery, and I wondered who on earth was sending me one. Since I ought to know what was contained in it, as apart from anything else, I'd twice typed out the complete contents of the publisher. So, I pulled it out, and you can imagine my surprise when only half of the book came out, the top half, like that. I then looked inside, saw the other part, and a folded-up note. Well, by this time, one or two other people in the office were eyeing me in rather a peculiar manner, and it occurred to me that questions would soon be asked, as it isn't really the custom in offices to produce a half-book and start perusing it. It also occurred to me that the note might possibly be an offensive one, so I hurriedly replaced the half-book and gave a sickly-looking grin at those who were staring at me and tried generally to give the impression that I always ordered half a book at a time, not very successfully in point of fact. However, when I reached home, I read the note. You've all got a copy of it, I hope. Yes, you have. Anyway, it was in undisguised handwriting, which in itself is most unusual for an anonymous letter, and it contains those verses, which I hope you've all read on the other duplicated sheet. Now, I say it contained the verses on that sheet, but that isn't absolutely correct. For when I had the sheet printed in 1968, I added a seventh verse of my own, for reasons of my own. This paid off to a degree, but unfortunately not to the degree where I'm in a position to enlighten all and sundry with what actually occurred. When I am, which will be when I have ample proof to convince others of what I believe to be the case, This will be published in the Cosmos Journal and elsewhere. Just one other general point. The postmark wasn't Hammersmith as is stated on the sheet. The actual postmark was Borough. The Borough, London SE1, which happens to be the main sorting office for South East London. This again I altered for reasons of my own. However, let's have another look at the verse and see what can be gleaned directly from it. Now, first of all, the reason I take it seriously lies in the name Markab, M-A-R-K-A-B. It's too much of a coincidence that this little referred to star should have been singled out at a time when I had an article, again an article which had not been published, coming out in the Bufora Journal. And this article mentioned Markab four times. Coincidences I normally distrust, but this one was just too good to be true. Next, as I've also put on the sheet, Cromwell's pub. Now, that wasn't mentioned in the Scottish Mystery, so whoever wrote this knew that the pub at Holme, where I'd frequently met Bryant and recorded him, had a plaque on the wall which bore the legend, Oliver Cromwell slept here. So far as the verse 1 is concerned, several suggestions have been made, all hypothetical, and I'm not concerning myself with this at this juncture. Verse 2 is self-explanatory. Verse 3 is quite correct so far as the convincing voice goes, and the reference to Brinsley Trench suggested to me a possible answer as to where Bryant might have picked up his knowledge that Adamski said he would return after death, but not as a baby, which was only known to Adamski's close friends. Now, don't misunderstand me there. I'm not for one moment suggesting that Brinsley Lepeur Trench has any connection with this at all. But what would have been more natural, say, than for Desmond Leslie, who was a friend of both, to have passed on Adamski's reincarnatory ideas from one to the other? All it needs then is one of our plotters, friendly with Brinsley Lepeur Trench, to have told him this in the course of conversation, or to have been told this, rather, and this information could have reached Bryant by word of mouth without any need of UFO literature at all. Verse 4 certainly describes Scotty Newton, the self-styled Dr. Milton L. Newton, BSc, MSc, DSc. I have some of his headed paper here for what it's worth. I'll be reading from it a little later on. Atomic physicist par excellence. And in addition, includes copies of his not infrequent grammatical errors. Verse 5, well, I'll only comment that my mind is not by any means as puzzled now as it was in 1968, and verse 6 I've already referred to. 3 points are to me the vital clues so far as the solving of this case is concerned. These are, firstly, the glass phial, which clue-wise must be held to be the crux of the whole thing. Secondly, the Adelphos Adelpho message. And lastly, the pieces held by Scotty Newton, which so exactly fitted those that we took to him. The pieces that Bryant had allegedly picked up, I have them here, I'll show them later on, had allegedly picked up after the second sighting. There can, of course, only be one reason why they did fit, that being that they came from the same thing. And they were planted on Scotty in order that when Eileen Buckle and myself eventually got around to seeing him, as knowing he allegedly had pieces of the Mantell plane we were bound to do, we would cry Eureka, which of course at the time we did. Now, to give everyone a clearer picture, I'm going to give some brief details about some of the main characters in the Skorriton Mystery to show how they fitted into the story. After the break, as I said, I'll be playing some recordings, and I think, as I said before, I can guarantee that you'll find those of Bryant and Scotty Newton particularly interesting. Anyway, first of all, Bryant himself. Bryant, did you know, bear a considerable facial resemblance to Adamski. At the time of his alleged contact and sighting, Bryant was aged 51. He was married with 2 daughters and a son. Son was Michael, aged 16, daughters Yvonne, 11, and Evelyn, 8. Although I later discovered that he was accustomed to telling the tale, I have a letter from one of his former employers which says exactly that, he was always convincing and sincere, and this was commented on by the majority of the numerous people who had subsequent dealings with him. I never knew him remotely even to lose his habitual calmness or his temper. And despite the fact that I now believe his story to being completely untrue, it's impossible to dislike him because of this. He was a most likeable character. So far as his apparent sincerity went, I had little doubts about this until after having done considerable delving with local people, the Home Office, various councils, newspapers and TV stations, he gave what I knew to be absolutely untrue answers to questions with exactly the same sincerity that he'd told the story of the sighting and the contact. This by itself, of course, does not necessarily mean that he was telling lies all the time, but it does mean there was absolutely no yardstick for measuring one or the other. As I've said, he was a very likeable person, and in my own opinion now, he was more sinned against than sinning, since one of his character traits was that he never used to like to go against what other people said or did for fear of offending them. And I think this trait was exploited and was what embroiled him in the contact story in the first place. Bryant died on the 24th of June 1967 of a brain tumour, which in itself automatically gives rise to controversy. All I can say is this: no two people, either specialists or laymen, have entirely agreed on actually on how long he'd had that brain tumour or exactly how it would have affected him. Obviously, those who favour the contact being true will like to see it as being caused by the saucer in some way. Those who are sceptical will more than likely view it the other way round. As far as this angle is concerned, it's really impossible to tell either way, which is why I myself form no conclusions at all on this particular and most unfortunate aspect of the case. Well, let's now turn to Gerald Aspin. I haven't mentioned him up to now this evening, but at the time of the sighting, he was treasurer of the Exeter Astronomical Society, and it was he who took away for examination the pieces that Bryant allegedly picked up, and it was he from whom we finally retrieved them. Gerald, to say the least of it, is a most unpredictable character. It has been suggested he was responsible for the entire hoax, and this must just lie within the realms of possibility. But I regard this possibility now as very slender indeed. It's also been stated that his own room was a UFO sanctuary. This is nonsense, as I've been in his room on several occasions. And while since he is interested in UFOs, he clearly has quite a number of books, magazines, and in his case, models, which he is quite proficient at making. He also has quite a large proportion of books, magazines and models connected with other subjects as well. Well, as I say, Gerald's a character on his own. He's about 26 or 27 now, I think. Some of you may remember he once appeared at a Bufora meeting dressed as a Venusian, complete with space costume and wig. He's also presented himself at Warminster for a Skywatch dressed as a German officer. Quite logical, since he believes himself to be one, reincarnated. He also believes himself to be a reincarnation of Christ, of Oliver Cromwell, shades of the Puppet Hole, I think, and of Mantell. This apart from the doubtful honour of considering me to be both Satan and a reincarnated Oliver Cromwell, too. Well, all I can say is that someone, either up or down there, must be having a hell of a time with their bookkeeping, as this means that both he and I are reincarnations of the same person at the same time, as well as he having been reissued with Mantell's soul, ego, psyche, or whatever you like to call it, before he died. Speaking as an auditor myself, I'd hate to have to try and sort that lot out. Gerald also had the unfortunate habit of suddenly coming up from Exeter, he may still have it for all I know, and arriving on one's doorstep for reasons only known to himself. At times, unfortunately, like 12 o'clock midnight, 3 o'clock in the morning, and just as one is getting up about 6:30. I'm by no means the only sufferer in this regard. Several others have experienced his attentions, more unwelcome ones than have been thrust on me in some cases. It's typical of him that when a friend of mine met him and said, "Glad to meet you," his reply was, "That remains to be seen." Actually, a perfectly true statement, though somewhat unexpected. Now, the two remaining people I shall talk about and refer to are our mad scientist friend, Scotty Newton, and Gary Byers, the other alleged contactee in the Scotterton mystery. But firstly, Scotty. We first came across him through being introduced by a friend who said that this chap too claimed to possess pieces of Mantell's plane, so we wrote to him and arranged an appointment. As I said a couple of years ago here, this he claimed to be descended from Sir Isaac Newton, In fact, I think he actually says so on this tape that I've got with me, that he claims to be descended via an unbroken line of antecedents, all, of course, visitors, which presents one or two problems, or one or two skeletons as well, for that matter. So I spent a whole afternoon researching into Sir Isaac's life history and found he'd never married. I gather that our friend is now saying that this was a misunderstanding and he really meant he was descended from Sir Isaac's half-brother, cousin, or some other such conveniently untraceable relative. Well, Scotty himself lives not far from Finsbury Park Station. He claims to be well over 70 but looks considerably younger. He is a quite impressive build with a large roundish face and a hint of a moustache. He has a beautiful American accent, you'll hear it later on, and he usually pads to the door to meet you, dressed in white overalls, complete with pencils, pens, slide rules, etc. in the top pocket. He'll then invite you in and invite you to hear all about his laboratory, computer, electronic brain, radio telescope, you name it, he'll tell you he's got it. He'll enrich your evening with stories of encounters with the FBI, CIA, MI5, Interpol, police, UFO personalities. He'll tell you all about his charitable works, his coin collections, his expeditions into Siberia, Cambodia, the Middle East, and elsewhere. He'll hear all about his and his group's remarkable scientific discoveries, how he broke the codes that the Russians and the Americans use in their satellites and probes, and is consequently in possession of all the information himself. These and 100 other things he'll tell you about. There's one point you always have to bear in mind, though, or he'll become nasty. That is, that since it's a form of game to him, you must never contradict him. In fact, you have to go along with him all the time. The only trouble is that, as I say, although a serious one to him, it is a game. That it's a game you have to play according to his rules, which makes it extremely difficult, but because you don't know what they are in the first place, and in any case, he changes them as he goes along. Things then tend to be somewhat confused, to say the least. After the first time, he would never again allow us to see the pieces which so exactly fitted our own, despite repeated requests. They were always at the bank, or with his solicitors. As I've said, it's my opinion that these were planted on him so that we might produce ours at the appropriate time to match them. I'll be playing a tape of his after the break, as I said, but you might possibly be interested in one or two excerpts from his letters. I've got one or two here, and I think I'll sit down to read them. These are two quotes from two letters way back in June 1966, and they'll show you the sort of thing you can expect from him. Quote, he's talking about the pieces we brought to him, you see. And he says, however, we've enlisted a friend of ours who is a ballistic expert at the Yard, and we should have his report back any day now. We've taken pictures of the 3/32-inch gear of the part you left here, and we've taken pictures of the top side of the autoconch drum, which is in our possession. With these negatives, we place them into our special projector. The markings fit perfectly. We've cleaned the parts you left here and compared the dirt with the dirt analysis of ours. So far, everything is positive. As for the metal, they are one and the same. You shall have the full analysis. Stress, vinyl strength, tensile strength, spectroscopic analysis, as well as the chemical analysis report in full. That was from one letter, and this is from another. The analysis has been completed to the most minute area of the parts you've brought to my home. They have now been checked and rechecked by different physicists, and we've gone so far as to have the laboratories at Cambridge to make some analysis. The Cambridge laboratories found exactly as we did to the decimal point. Now, first of all, you were not aware, to my knowledge, that the Mantell craft disintegrated due to a beam of light or a laser, maser, double proton or something similar, that was the cause of Mantell's death. This was beyond a shadow of a doubt now. That was a favourite phrase of his, incidentally. To the most rigid examination, the parts you brought to my home for analysis, we found that in at least five places where the unit produced signs of a disintegration. You can now see the places with your naked eye. Secondly, they've been marked. He very often puts secondly without putting a firstly. Last but not least, there's a hell of a lot of this last, actually, we found red dust and also cream-coloured dust. The first is the dust which comes from the red bed formation, which lies just above the Cambrian periods. We do not have any dust of this kind in England. It can only be found in the USA. Now, the second type of dust derives from the Dawson Arcos Formation, and again, this is only found in the middle west of the USA. The Dawson Arcos Formation lies above the Perry Shale Formation. The chemical analysis of the pieces you've brought to my home are identical with the parts I have here. As you know, I procured these parts myself at Fort Knox, Kentucky. In brackets, some distance from Fort Knox, actually. There's so much more to say, I think it best for you to come to my home and we'll discuss the matter as to the report. There is no charge for our services. Well, that's probably enough to give you some idea of what this particular gentleman was like. So I'll pass on to the final person, Gary Byers, or Myers, as he was called in the Scorriton mystery. Perhaps so, before I do, it occurs to me that some of you may well be thinking, OK, this chap's talking a lot about hoaxes and the Scorriton mystery. What about those odd tape messages of his then? Are those hoaxes too? To which my answer would be, in a sense, I think this could well be so, though certainly not a conscious one on my part. I'm going to spend very little time on these, since even in the book I made it quite plain that I considered they were of doubtful ufological significance. That view I still maintain, as do I also maintain the various possible explanations suggested in the Scorriton mystery. Perhaps one or two of them now seem more likely than others, but that is all. However, to Gary Byers. Now, Gary had had, allegedly at any rate, a number of saucer experiences which were related in detail in the Scorriton mystery. As I had been present myself on one occasion, and it was thought there was a possible connection with the Bryant case. Anyway, Gary's first experience was at the green at Thaden Boyce, when, from where he was parked, he saw a dazzling bright igloo-shaped object about the size of his car, only about 15 yards away. He turned his car in a wide circle to get a better view of the thing, and as he did so, the thing vanished. This was on January the 4th, 1965. Several other people reported seeing UFOs that night, but not on the ground. Well, his next experience was on Monday, April the 24th, 1966, when he was in his bedroom on the point of going to bed, and he heard a voice inside his head urging him to go to this self-same spot the following morning. It was a man's voice speaking in a flat tone, he told us. Well, he went to the green, he sat on a log there, and at about 9:30, a small silvery black egg-shaped disc appeared and hovered a few hundred feet overhead. He again heard the voice, which told him he'd been directed there for reassurance, and the voice also made a reference to George Adamski. A few weeks afterwards, Gary was going to see Ron Caswell, who lived at Harlow, and Ron Caswell of IGAT, that is, and he was going along with his engine cut out in a lay-by as he was approaching Harlow. He went into the lay-by, and as he was peering under the bonnet, a voice said, "Having trouble, and don't you recognise my voice?" And there was a man behind Gary who went on to say, "There'll be something big on at Everly on Whit Sunday, that West gets some people down there." He walked away, Gary turned back to the engine, and when he looked up again, the man had vanished. Well, Gary told Ron Caswell about this, and Ron did get a party down there, about 24, including myself, there being Everly in Wiltshire between Amesbury and Devizes. Gary, of course, also came. Clearly, the implication was that there'd be some sort of flyover or landing, always assuming that Gary was telling the truth. Well, it was a sunny day, and absolutely nothing happened until about 4:15, when Gary, who was walking with Ron Caswell away from the others, suddenly put his hands to his head and fell down, afterwards saying he'd heard the voice again, very loudly, and he said it had said, "We are coming in over the big stones, give us a guiding light." The big stones being an obvious reference to Stonehenge, some 15 miles away, and a guiding light was provided on and off by the car's headlamps when dusk arrived. But, as is not at all unusual, nothing happened. At a later meeting with Gary, this isn't mentioned in the Scorriton mystery incidentally, he gave the name of the man, or the supposed name of the man, that he'd seen at the car, and also apparently he'd seen some months later as well. Now, he told us that the name of this man, who was an extraterrestrial, was Secris, S-E-C-R-I-S. Well, I'll finish on the following note and leave you in mid-air. Not too far up, though, I hope. Anyway, some months later still, Gary produced a photograph of a landed saucer at the green at Thaden Boyce, supposed to have been taken subsequent to the incidents at Everly and so on. Well, I haven't seen this photo, but all those who have, including those who fully accepted the truth of Gary's experiences, say that this is one of the most obvious fakes they've ever seen. And the word space hoax were being freely bandied about in this connection too. But one final point here, which so far as I'm aware is unknown up till now to anyone else, and it's this. Gary had told us all along he was very keen on pop music. In fact, he himself played in a group, and he could rattle off the names of those in pop groups like nobody's business. Now, you'll remember that I said he told us that the name of his alleged visitant was Secris, spelled S-E-C-R-I-S. Well, I was walking along in Catford one evening, and there were a lot of small posters advertising various events, one of which caught my eye. This gave the name of a pop group I'd never heard before, who were performing at a local club or a local pub. And after their name, it said, Vocals by Secris. Well, a coincidence? I'll leave you to judge. And there I'll finish for the moment.